Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I saw a film. Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. And we're back. We have another fun selection of direct and indirect mop-top adjacent movies to discuss over the next 10 or so weeks, possibly with some surprises thrown in along the way. But before we start, please remember to subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to it, as well as find us on social media. We are at Beatles Films Pod and available for Beatles chats, opinions and memes over on Instagram, X, Threads and Facebook. And if you enjoy this podcast or any of our episodes, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating or a review. We'd really appreciate it. But for now, to kick off this new season, we'll be discussing the 1988 documentary Imagine, John Lennon, with behind-the-scenes access and archive footage. The film explores John's life and career as a Beatle, a solo artist, a husband, a father, and, well, just as a man. When I think of this film, I think this is probably the first time I ever was exposed to John Lennon as a solo artist. I think, you know, I think of this film a little bit in the same way that I think of the Red and Blue albums. Like, I grew up on those as my gateway into the Beatles, and I kind of feel like this is the first time I really understood that John Lennon had a whole separate sort of life and career outside of his music with the Beatles. This is the first time I kind of saw that in action. I don't know if that was the same for you.
Yeah, quite similar, actually. I think I probably saw this for the first time in the early 90s. It was on the TV and I recorded it onto VHS and I watched it quite a lot. But yeah, I mean, having been a Beatles fan since I was a kid, I didn't really know anything about any of their solo work. I didn't really have any relationship with it other than I'd probably heard Mull of Kintyre. That was probably about it. And this probably introduced me to the idea of John Lennon the man, and in particular John Lennon the artist, if you like, you know.
Yeah.
His sort of artistic pursuits as well as his musical ones. And I do think it's interesting you say, like, you know, the Red and Blue albums, because actually I think generationally you and I are of a generation whereby we were probably introduced to the Beatles by our parents playing the Red and Blue albums, i.e. they would have got them in the 70s and been playing them in the 80s.
Yes.
And that's probably where we got it from. So this documentary, I would have been roughly eight or 9 years old when it came out, so a bit young for it then. But for when it was then on television, when I was 12 or 13 or whatever I was, pretty much at exactly the right age for it.
And that's what I mean, yeah. I guess I probably wouldn't have been a kid, but I probably would have been a young teenager when I saw this. And at an age where, you know, you can actually follow and understand and appreciate what's in the documentary. It has to be said as well, though, that I think, you know, we've both watched the film again to record this episode. The version of the film to watch is rated 18 because there's... I mean, there's a degree of nudity in the film.
Yeah.
But there's obviously one very specific and very famous C-bomb.
Yes.
Which I think is what earns the film its 18. 18 rating.
Come together, right?
Yes, exactly. Yes, exactly, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Obviously, there's that scene as well, which we shouldn't mention. So I guess two things there. One, that I'm assuming the version that I saw first time around when I was much younger wasn't this version. Because I don't think, you know, when I was younger, I watched lots of like horror films and things like that. But I was way too young to watch as a kid. But it doesn't feel like the version that would have been shown on TV that I probably would have caught. And the other thing as well about all this is just, it's a bit weird that there's an 18 rated version of this documentary to begin with, because it's like, you know, it's a celebration of John Lennon's life. Like, why would you make it adult rated? You know, it feels a little bit strange that they've done that for the sake of keeping in that C-bomb.
Right, yeah, because yeah, it must have been only that. I think perhaps it probably would have got a 15 or so.
Yeah,
were it not for that. Yeah, it's a sort of odd creative decision. I guess maybe it speaks to what it was they wanted to achieve with this. So I think, I mean, this film, in terms of when it came out, is probably pretty key to the sort of mythos of John Lennon, the posthumous mythos of John Lennon. And I think this is probably, it feels to me like maybe the first instance of John Lennon product being released posthumously. So like, we're very used to John Lennon product now with sort of remastered box sets and things like that. But this feels like maybe the first kind of flag in the sand of like, here is this guy and this is what we're going to do with his legacy.
Yes. Yeah, I see what you mean.
And I think I have a really specific memory of actually my best friend's older brother, who would have been 3 years older than us, sort of being in his bedroom, and he had somewhere, maybe on his wall or something, he had the doodle that appears on the cover, you know, the DVD cover and all the promotional material for this documentary, the sort of self-portrait doodle that John did. So he was like quite a big Lennon fan. He was kind of into the iconography. So he being a bit older, like he had the White Album and stuff, which is something I'd never heard.
Yeah.
And that was, I can sort of remember him having Bungalow Bill on me and me not knowing what it was and not knowing it was the Beatles and things like that, you know. But I think for a sort of, an older teenager, he probably would have been 15 or 16 or something. You can completely see the appeal of having been a Beatles fan when you were a kid. But now here's the stuff about this guy, and it's a bit more earthy and it's a bit more real, you know. But actually, one of the things about that doodle is sort of, I think it's such a big part of the John Lennon iconography now. You know, it kind of features the round glasses, which obviously is the most iconic part of his image and the way people think about him now. And actually, I think that doodle kind of is something chosen to sort of represent John as an image. It's quite sort of whimsical, you know.
Yeah.
It draws himself as sort of a benign, slightly specky figure, you know, with his hair messed up, you know, bit of a dreamer, that kind of thing, you know, as if he's sort of whistling a carefree tune, you know. So like the logo doesn't necessarily say, oh, this guy was a political firebrand or anything like that.
No, that's true. But then also, you know, as we've said many times before, and we'll no doubt repeat ourselves several times over in this episode.
Sure.
There are so many conflicting sides to John. Mm. It almost makes sense that the whimsical depiction of him is the one that he's best remembered for, because yeah. I guess there's, you know, everything that he did, there was still sort of that sort of sense of humor that he kept with him even when he was being a political firebrand, like you say.
Yeah.
The interesting thing, you know, where you mentioned there about this being sort of his first posthumous product, I think you could be forgiven when watching this film for not realizing that it was released posthumously. Because I think that there's so much footage from this that it feels like it's in the immediate aftermath of the Beatles breaking up, where you have all of that very famous footage at Tizenhurst and the making of the Imagine album, that it, for a long stint of the film, it feels like this is a promotional tie-in to the release of that album as it was made then, you know, in the same way that we covered the Flaming Pie documentary last season. So I actually, you know, it's quite interesting, I think, when the film develops, where you have a lot of footage from that time, and then actually it gets to a point where it skips forward quite dramatically to the rest of his career and covers a lot of that in a short space of time, relatively speaking, to the recording sessions for the Imagine album.
Yeah, and it's I mean, that footage at Tittenhurst was being shot, I mean, partly because John and Yoko were quite into the idea of documenting their lives. Mm-hmm. You know, I suppose, you know, the song, the ballad of John and Yoko is almost the start of that, this sort of autobiography through their art, you know, mm-hmm. this idea that Yoko in particular was very keen on, and John was as well, you know, which perhaps came about a lot through her influence, was this idea that all art is in and of itself about the artist, and that's inescapable. That everything you do is an expression of who you are, and therefore, in a sense, it might as well be quite a literal one, you know.
Yeah.
So you really, you are always expressing a part of yourself, and so you might as well say, okay, here is a film of everything I do, you know, everything I'm doing day to day. Be those things quite mundane, you know, like eating beans on toast as he does in this film, you know, and you know. But yeah, that was being shot for, so it's sort of promotional material for Imagine, the album. So bits of this sort of ended up in the sort of conceptual art film, which is also called Imagine. But other bits kind of end up in a more recent documentary called John and Yoko Above Us Only Sky, which came out in, I can't tell you exactly, but in the last 5 years or so. But with a much more a similar footage, but a lot more of a kind of talking heads approach of people who were there at the time. So it's funny that all this stuff is being shot at all.
Yeah.
It's great and it's valuable that it is, you know, because as I'm sure we'll get on to discuss, there's an awful lot of this footage is stuff that some of the first things you think of when you think of post-Beatle John Lennon footage.
And this, yeah, this is what I was going to say, because I think, you know, going back to my point of this is my first exposure to John as a solo artist or a man with a career beyond the Beatles, there's so much about what I think of him that comes from this documentary that I don't see elsewhere, or I haven't seen elsewhere. Yeah. There were clips in this documentary that I actually think about often, you know, and having not really seen it since I first saw it from when I was much younger, you know, like when he plays Imagine for the first time as a demo, and there's someone in the studio who says, oh, I quite like that. And he says, yeah, that's my favorite one. That's always stuck with me, weirdly. Like I just remember watching that for the first time and just being struck by the fact that even at that point, he knew that it was a special song. Yeah. Or a special song to him. And yeah, I always find that quite fascinating. And equally, the footage from the bedding, where you know, he has the full on argument with the cartoonist.
Yeah.
You know, the argument where he says very specifically, when, you know, it's put to him that he's only doing it for money, and he says something like, "I could write a song in an hour and make more money." Mm. And I just remember at the time watching that, being like, "Well, yeah, you could actually. That's a really good. That's the end of the argument. That's absolutely.
Yeah.
That is a winning claim to make." So yeah, there's parts in this documentary that are just, they kind of like pervade, I think, the John Lennon's reputation and sort of opposition. It all comes from this film.
Yeah, definitely. So I think you kind of see the best and the worst of him. It's mainly the best, yeah, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of the slant of it, which we'll sort of get onto later, but because you do see things like him sort of like being very compassionate towards the homeless guy who's kind of turned up in his garden.
Yeah, sure.
But you also see him taking great glee in recording How Do You Sleep, and being the conversation he and George are having with each other. George has come around to play guitar on the song and they're having a cup of tea first. And they're making sort of these references to Beatle Ed and how he's not doing so well these days and things. Yeah. You know, and it's obvious they're talking about Paul, and John does a big theatrical stage wink.
See much of the Beatles these days? The other Beatles, there's a great
Beatle Ed,
how is he?
He was all right, but he was just going off on a tour.
Beatle Ed's not doing so well these days, is he, Beatle Ed?
Well, he's number five in Sweden.
Oh, in Sweden, that's it.
I mean, so what we don't see in this is the fact that Ringo turned up at the session either this day or the next or whatever it was, and just said, "That's enough, John. Like, you know, this is too much. Like,
yeah,
you know, you need to knock it on the head." You know,
didn't stop them from releasing the song, though, did it?
No, did that. Fair enough. It's a good song as well, by the way.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, good song. Yeah, that is, always strikes me as, you know, I think we live in an age now where we'll have both been served lots and lots of short clips on social media that are related to Beatles through following different, you know, Beatles groups on different platforms and stuff. And the How You Sleep clip where they're recording that together, John and George recording that together, comes up quite a lot for me.
Yeah.
As does the homeless guy turning up at his house. It's first of all, it's interesting that, you know, a lot of that footage, or footage that I think is quite interesting about John at his time, again, seems to have originated from this documentary, but it still lives on in these short sort of snippets, these sort of social media type bites now. But also it's interesting that whenever I watch that How You Sleep clip, it always strikes me that I'm surprised at George being complicit in that sentiment.
Yes. So where they are at that time is, I suppose, like Paul has sued them. What is this? 1971, I think. So Paul has sued them at this point, and I guess they're in the middle of all that legal wrangling. So, you know, this is the point at which it's the other three versus Paul.
Yeah.
That's kind of where everyone is. So, yeah, it's funny. I always think it's a bit weird, you know, George coming around. You know, he's quite enthusiastically taking part in this. It's quite symbolic as well. Because, I mean, George is obviously a great slide guitar player, but John could have got a session guy to play slide guitar on that.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. There's a reason why George has been hired for that song.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That's part of it, isn't it? When you watch that clip, it's like that. There's you know, it's not just that you're seeing them record that song together. It's the only time you see the two of them record anything together post Beatles breaking up.
So I think George is playing on a couple of songs on that record. I couldn't tell you exactly which ones, but yeah, you're right. I'm not sure they're collaborating much.
I know there's much reported discussion about John being invited to perform a concert for Bangladesh, and there are conversations between the two of them collaborating and stuff, but in terms of actual footage of them playing together after Beatles breaking up, can't think of anything else. Yeah, well, this is the first one that comes to mind.
Yeah,
so in that sense, it's very pointed that it is to record a song that is very aggressively antagonistic against Paul.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it's quite, you know, you kind of look at George and you're quite, I mean, you know, speaking of having a homeless guy turn up at your house, I mean, let's be frank, George looks like shit when he's, like he's really, I don't know, just got that weird scraggly beard that he had around that time. And his hair is just all over the place and stuff. I mean, listen, this is George Harrison. He looks better than me, you know. But I don't know. I always kind of associated the fact that he turned up looking a bit like a hobo, you know. And I think he's eating like beans on toast. And I think there's a bit where he like gets a bean in his beard or something like that, you know. And he just, but he looks. But the reason I'm saying this is that when he turns up, I always kind of thought, well, maybe George isn't in the greatest place at the moment either mentally. Mm. You know, maybe he, I think George always sort of immediately post Beatles was the one who was kind of the most obviously liberated. But he did also kind of immediately seek other collaborators.
Yeah.
You know, so I think I'm not sure he was just so completely gung ho about it that he didn't miss them at all. But I just don't think it's something he would have admitted. You know?
Yeah, sure. I mean, in the scenes that we see him in this film, I feel like he seems a little bit quiet, a bit muted.
Right.
Yeah. Whereas John is obviously, you know, typical John. He's very animated, particularly in singing that song. And even when he's, you know, singing about, you know, when he says like, I can't remember the lyric is now, the best thing you did was yesterday.
Yeah.
And it cuts to George almost reacting to that line, but he's not reacting to the line. It's not like he's giving like a wry smile. It's like, yeah, stick it to him, John, or anything like that. Like he's there to play the guitar.
Yeah.
Like he's not contributing to the sentiment of the song in any way, in any visible way.
Yeah.
But the fact that he is there means that he is complicit in that he knows the context of the song that they're singing. So he's obviously quite happy to take part in it. Yeah. But that surprised me because also I think it surprises everyone when you hear John drop the C-bomb in reference to Paul.
Yeah.
And then you realize just how bad that relationship got between them at that time. but also that's John.
Yeah.
Like, you can believe John doing that.
Yeah.
But this is spiritual enlightened George. You know, it's just a little bit of a contrast to what we expect from him to be taking part in that.
Yeah, that's true. I think because Yoko justifies how do you sleep in voiceover in this film as well, along the lines of saying, well, Paul had attacked John in song, so John just kind of felt like he wanted to respond to that.
Paul wrote some songs that was like a private message, so to speak, and John was upset about those songs, and so that's how it happened. It was like a reply to Paul rather than a message to Paul.
So Sergeant Pepper took you by surprise.
So, I mean, that is true. That Paul, you know, by his own admission now, Too Many People was kind of about John and Yoko, the song off Ram, which he kind of felt was about their sort of hypocrisy of them as sort of telling everyone what to do. And he kind of felt like he was a bit fed up with that. That was aimed at John and Yoko. I think John felt there were other songs.
Yeah, there's the song Three Legs, right? Which is about the, you know, my three-legged dog, right?
Yeah.
I think John thought that was like the band without him.
Oh, okay.
Right. I remember reading something about how that's how he felt the song about him. I don't think that's one that Paul has come forward and admitted was about the band at the time.
No.
But there's always time, because Paul does tend to retroactively say, yeah, my song was actually about this.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm still not convinced that Piece of Cake was actually Piss Off Cake, which I think he has claimed in recent years.
Yeah, no, yeah, he's quite pleased with that one, isn't he?
And John was the cake, of course. But so going back to the clips, yeah, I do think it's interesting that a lot of what we consider now to be quite famous post-Beatles John clips, it seems to have originated in this documentary. There are a few things in this film that I don't remember seeing before at all.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed seeing interview with, I mean, you would have known this one, but I don't remember seeing before, interview with the Beatles where after they received their MBE and they're asked if it changes the way they're writing songs, and they talk about, well, it's much more comfortable on a cushion now. Yeah, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
You all live in well, good domestic splendor. Has this affected your writing, Paul and John?
No, it's easier to write with cushions. And so, now on pieces of hard bench, which, you know, we were on hard benches before we made it.
Yeah, and the slime and
on the cellar of Liverpool. And it's much easier on a nice cushion.
But I was like, that's great. I don't remember seeing that before. There was this footage of John being asked about the lyrics to Revolution. And what he means by "you can count me out in,"
right?
And he answers that, and I think I've seen that, you know, him talking about that written down before. I've read that, but I don't remember seeing the footage of him answering that before. And he is not in a right frame of mind or a good state, and he's on something in that moment then, because the way he responds to that, he's very, very slow and not quite with it.
I think so. I could be wrong, but I think that in that is the interview that in Get Back we don't see, but is discussed, whereby he and Yoko have gone off to do an interview for, I think it's Canadian TV, and John had to stop and throw up during the interview.
Ah, right.
So yeah. I think it's, I'm not completely sure.
I do remember that being discussed in Get Back, right?
So yeah.
But yeah, and that would explain it.
yeah.
Quite clearly.
Yeah, he's not at his best.
With regards to all of this, by the way, we should point out that obviously throughout the documentary, there isn't a sort of chronological telling of John's career, which I think in itself is an interesting artistic choice to make. But I think the way it is told actually works really well. So we are introduced to John post-Beatles career, and then it goes back to the start of the Beatles and him growing up, Aunt Mimi, his mother, and the Quarrymen in those years, and that takes them up to about Twist and Shout, and then we're back with John post-career, and there's these sort of sporadic sort of flashback moments that then picks up the Beatles' career from where we last left it. It never feels disjointed, though.
Yeah.
It always feels quite like a smooth transition between those segments, which is quite... I think the fact that we don't notice that that's what it's doing is quite a good achievement.
Yeah, that's true. I think it is. It isn't strictly chronological, but I suppose what it's doing is following him rather than following the Beatles. And though obviously those, there's an awful lot of correlation between those timelines. They're not exactly the same in terms of the sort of peaks and troughs of his career.
Mm.
So he is talking about things like the, you know, these are the people who joined the band, but Paul was the guy who I picked as my partner. I think that's what he says, you know. So, like while a general Beatles documentary would focus more on how they all got together, the point they're more making is the partnership between John and Paul. Although that actually isn't stressed an awful lot throughout the rest of the film.
No, but I guess what I mean is just the general jumping back and forth.
Yeah,
time. Like I get that it's not going to go into any great detail about the Beatles as a band because this is a very much obviously a John Lennon documentary.
Yeah,
but the fact that it's almost like a parallel chronological narrative in tandem. It starts off with John post-Beatles career. At the same time, it tells John pre-Beatles.
Mm.
And then it follows both at the same time and skips back between one and the other.
Right.
Which is just an interesting choice to have made rather than, you know, a straight linear narrative from, you know, this was the Beatles, this is what happened, and now here's John as a solo artist.
Yeah.
I think it's quite effective in splitting it into two. One of the things I like about it most is because that's the choice that the film has made, we get a really quick run through of the Beatles' career. It skips out loads of stuff, which is quite remarkable. Like they barely mention India at all.
Yeah, right.
And the entire White album just doesn't exist pretty much.
Yeah.
Nor I think does Abbey Road. But you know, one like so straight away, for example, in the first Beatles segment in the film, it talks about like the how rough and violent their time in Hamburg was, and you have their booking manager Alan Williams talking about how, you know, a drunk confronted John on stage, and there was a bit of a fight, and they used to get bought loads of beer so that they were really drunk when they were playing and stuff. And then it kind of almost immediately cuts to them very, very clean cut after meeting Brian Epstein performing Love Me Do on TV. And it's like, actually, it's quite an interesting juxtaposition between the sort of rough and ready Hamburg days to the complete boy band image overhaul they had to go through and agree to in order to properly kickstart a career in pop music.
Yeah, it kind of seems to be making that point. So the idea of whether they not sold out, but whether they said, okay, we need to clean up our act in order to be popular is slightly contentious, I suppose. So John kind of cops to that in his kind of later interviews, said, oh yeah, like our best stuff was never recorded. Hamburg, you know, when we were like pure rock and roll artists, that was it was. And then, you know, then we got soft for the TV and for Hollywood, you know. But, you know, and then Paul has said, well, yeah, but like nobody had to be sort of dragged to the tailors to get the suits done, things like that. But I think, so if you think about Complete Beatles as a documentary, which preceded this by 6 years, so that covers the same thing, but probably more gradually. So from memory, I don't remember feeling like it was jarring that going so quickly from Hamburg excess, you know, to playing Love Me Do on stage. Hamburg, they have footage. It's not so much footage of the Beatles in Hamburg, but it is footage of just drunks fighting in the street in the Reeperbahn. Barn.
Yeah.
And that footage is fantastic. And I wasn't sure where it came from, actually, because obviously it wasn't shot for this and it wasn't shot for anything to do with the Beatles, because it's just...
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? They found footage to back up the point that is being made at that time, but it's obviously not Beatles-related footage.
Yeah.
So you say it's not shot for this, unless they literally just sent the cameraman to the roughest street in Hamburg.
Straight down the Reeper Bar and just bought everyone a load of booze and said, right, fight! Exactly.
This is cheaper than buying archive footage to use in the documentary. So, but yeah, it's an odd thing to see, isn't it? That was the first time where I realised, oh, this is a film that has a sort of a harder edge to it.
Yeah,
but a little bit unnecessarily so, because you don't need to show that footage. You've got someone saying that, you know, they were in fights. You don't need to show actual physical street violence in the film.
No, right, exactly. But as you say, with the dropping of the C-bomb and the nudity late on as well, there are choices made that, I mean, were obviously deliberate, and so you can only surmise that the choice has been made to, well, I don't know, I was going to say, you know, the choice has been made to not sugarcoat anything, but they sugarcoat a lot in this, but they sugarcoat what they want to sugarcoat. But what I mean is, like, the thing where they want to show that something was excessive, then they do, you know, and they do it in a fairly explicit way, you know.
So, talking of sugarcoating, we should get into that. So, this is a film that transpired because it was originally commissioned by Yoko Ono.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, when watching this film, it's worth bearing that in mind, because there's obviously a degree of bias or sanitization that has been placed in the editing of this film. But I'm in two minds about this, because I think there are some moments where I think that's really obvious, but there are also some moments where it's like, oh, you really have not shied away from this difficult subject matter when you could have.
Yeah.
And, you know, it does that sort of in equal measure almost. I think one of the areas that it does sort of treat John perhaps a little bit too kindly is his role as a father to Julian.
Yeah.
Even when Cynthia Lennon comes on screen and is interviewed about it, she seems to be letting John off quite lightly about their relationship and his relationship with Julian, and the narrative from John at that time. And by the way, talking about how much we should trust the film in its honesty, the film starts with a caption saying, narrated by John Lennon over 100 hours of interviews.
Yeah.
It's not really narrated by John Lennon. There's lots of people who speak throughout the whole film and are telling the story. There's right. no real actual narration or anything like that narration. But it does feel like the only reason that is there is to make the point that this is John in his own words, even though it's not.
Mm.
So it's sort of presenting a case for this is a reliable depiction of John's life because it's coming from John himself, and then goes on to shows quite a lot of instances in the film where you kind of suspect that things are being glossed over.
Yeah.
So at the point where we are hearing about John as a father to Julian, John's narration, in quotation marks at that point, is him saying, I was just, you know, like any man, I was just working a lot.
Yeah.
Which kind of feels like it's letting him off the hook a little bit for not having a relationship with his son.
Yeah, he says something like, oh, I don't remember seeing Julian much. Julian is in this film as a talking head, and he's talking about not having had much of a relationship with John when he was younger, but then having more of a relationship with him when he got a bit older. And then you get John's voiceover saying, I don't remember seeing him much when he was a kid.
Yeah.
And he sort of excuses himself, and then you get Cynthia immediately as a talking head saying, she basically excuses John for it. And she says, he was forced to be a part-time dad, I think she says.
Yeah.
I don't remember seeing him as a child. You know, it was the height of the Beatle thing, so I was working all the time. I never considered what it was doing to him. I didn't even count it. The mother was at home. I was away. Like most guys at 24, 25, they're too intent on the career, really, you know?
John, as a father, was forced, I'm afraid, to be a part-time dad. He wrote to me saying that, Sin, I'm so sad and I'm so sorry that I've missed the fact that Julian has been growing up, that he is now a little man, and I miss him dreadfully, and I've been a right bastard because, you know, I've taken no notice of him and I've read the papers and pushed him out of the room because he's been making noise. And he said that was the point when he suddenly realised that he was a father. Julian was a special little person, not just a figment of his imagination when he came home in the early days.
There's a broad truth to that, I suppose. You know, when you're a Beatle, you don't have that much free time. Certainly, when Julian was born, was around when sort of Beatlemania was kicking off,
touring everywhere.
Or just before,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, he had very, very little free time, and so it was kind of inevitable that was going to happen, I suppose. I mean, these days that kind of thing would be treated quite differently, I'm sure. You know, someone like that would make a lot more time for their child. But so I don't mean to excuse it at all, because, by the way, I mean, John, when he was off on tour, he was also, you know, doing things that pop stars on tour like doing. You know, there were groupies and there was drinking and there was drugs and stuff.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't think he was thinking to himself, I wish I was at home with my wife and my son.
Yeah, exactly. I just, you know, work is keeping me from my family.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. You know, so there's a bit of both. But, you know, everyone's kind of on board, it seems to me. So, I mean, because Julian Lennon's a sort of interesting case here, because he's in this as a talking head, talking about John as a father. And by this point, Julian is a pop star in his own right. He's had a couple of hit singles, Too Late for Goodbyes being the sort of main one that everyone knew by that point. So he is a sort of artist in his own right, and he's doing pretty well. And sort of just post John's death, Julian was sort of making statements about the fact that he didn't think he was a very good dad. And sort of 10 years after this film, he does an interview with the Daily Telegraph in 1998, where he says that he, my dad could talk about peace and love to the world, but he could never show it to his wife and son, you know. Mm. So either this is capturing Julian at a time when he feels quite sanguine about John, or it has edited what he said to only leave in the positive bits.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't think that he's gone on a big rant and they've just edited it all out, you know, just to leave it, you know, sounding nice. I think the things he says, he seems to mean. But I mean, you know, he's not the only one here who has probably been edited in such a way to sort of cut out bits that the film doesn't want to show, you know.
No, I mean, and I think the other clear example of that is May Pang,
yeah,
as well. So we know, obviously, from our episode on her recent film, The Lost Weekend, A Love Story, and our interview with May herself, we know a lot more now about what her relationship with John was like during the time period that we call The Lost Weekend. In this film, there is no real mention of May having a loving relationship with John.
Yeah.
The Lost Weekend is really held in a very sort of damning light.
Yeah.
We have Elliot Mintz, who's like a advisor, like confidant of Yoko Ono.
Yeah, very much a sort of spokesperson for the Lennon Ono, but in particular the Ono camp, I
think. Yeah. He's a sort of a very particular fellow who is interviewed, looks very smart, and talks in a very clipped way, and he says that The Lost Weekend is an exercise in the depths of foolishness. And we hear about how obviously it's John acting like he was on a bachelor party that just and happened to last for 18 months or however long it lasted.
Yeah.
There is May providing a counterpoint to that, which is very interesting, where she says actually he had a very productive period during the time that most people call The Lost Weekend. He was making albums and he was collaborating with lots of people, which is actually a fantastic point to make, which we don't hear often enough.
Yeah.
But that is the only thing we really hear her saying about this, and there was no mention really of them actually being in a relationship together.
No, that's right. So Yoko, in her account, sort of talks about The Lost Weekend, as it were, as something where she says it sort of become obvious that the public were a bit sick of us appearing together. So I thought it'd be good for us to spend some time apart. And I said, well, why don't you just go off to Los Angeles? You know, just leave me alone for a bit, that kind of thing. You know, she sort of paints it as like, you know, I just sort of wanted to get him out of my hair for a bit. We thought our assistant May would be the perfect person to go with him because John couldn't really organize anything by himself. Yeah. He just needed. So this film, if you didn't know any better, she is then a talking head who talks only about the fact that he was like creatively quite fruitful during that period.
Yeah.
But if you didn't know any better, you'd think she was just a personal assistant who went with him on this. And she is now giving her eyewitness accounts of having been there as a personal assistant. There's absolutely no mention that they had any romantic relationship whatsoever.
Clearly it was necessary for somebody to be with John. Ms. Pang seemed like a logical choice. I mean, nothing gets done with John unless there's somebody there. And Yoko suggested that she would be the ideal companion for John for this mission.
That lost weekend that everybody keeps talking about, it wasn't so lost. People saw more of John than they had in the previous years, and he was out and about a lot. He recorded several albums, starting with Mind Games to Rock and Roll to Walls and Bridges. And he worked with Ringo on his album. There's also David Bowie, when they collaborated on David Bowie's first number one hit song, Fame. And also Elton John, when we went to Caribou. So there was a lot going on.
So while it's true that at the time, John kind of kept May out of the spotlight. It was known about, she was in sort of newspapers and things like that. But moreover, this film, there is a wider context around this film's release, and it was released only a few months after the release of the Albert Goldman book, The Lives of John Lennon, which is a sort of, which we've mentioned once or twice before on this podcast, which is a sort of famous character assassination full of mistruths and accusations of various improprieties. And this film was a sort of counterpoint to that. I mean, it was going to come out anyway. It's a coincidence they came out near to each other. But the reason why I mention it is because May Pang was on the Geraldo Rivera show around that time of its release, so a couple of months before the release of this documentary, talking about the fact that she and John were lovers. So it's not like in the context of this film, this is just some woman popping up who was a personal assistant.
Yeah.
People will generally know that she is in this film. She's John Lennon's ex-girlfriend who is in this film, making no mention of the fact that they had any romantic relationship.
Yeah.
So it's a bit weird.
Yeah. And then kind of obviously goes against this idea of this being an objective view of Lennon's life.
Yeah.
But going back to what we were saying before, there are moments in the film like that where you feel like, oh, you have to take some things with a pinch of salt because this is a Yoko commissioned film.
Yeah.
But there are other moments in the film where actually, given that information, it's surprising they were left in. Like, there are times when John isn't seen in a particularly great light. You know, there's the scene in the studio where he's having a go at the guy at the control desk because he's trying to sing the harmonies
to Oyoko.
That's right, yeah. And really, like, berates him for not getting the right piece. Like, you know, there's no need to leave that in the film, really.
Yeah.
And it only shows him in a sort of intolerant light.
Yeah.
And perhaps most interestingly for a Yoko commissioned film, it includes George Martin talking about how when Yoko first came on the scene as part of her relationship with John, she was always in the control room with him. And George Martin says that everyone found her really irritating and found her very difficult to deal with.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, we've talked a lot about, you know, the perpetuation of the myth of Yoko being the catalyst for the breakup of the Beatles and how much truth there is in that and how much that needs to be sort of readdressed. But it's interesting that in this film, at a time when Yoko would have been bearing the brunt of that sort of public negative opinion of her, that George Martin talking about her in such a negative light was left in the film.
Yeah.
When again, given the hours of footage that they would have been edited through, didn't need to be in, really.
Yeah, true. I wonder if, though, I mean, so you could make the case that she might have wanted to keep it in because it kind of showed her as the victim of mistreatment by the Beatles camp in general, maybe. I don't particularly think that is what it'll be. I think it's more probably that, listen, like she said, the director, Andrew Salt, who she commissioned this because she wanted an objective view from someone, which is kind of what she thought. I mean, this guy had sort of made documentaries about Elvis before, which she must have watched and enjoyed. So she says that she did want some objectivity. Now, what was delivered was certainly not objectivity.
Yeah.
It is pretty slanted in favor of John Lennon. It doesn't exactly kind of canonize him, but it is showing him in the best light. I think actually she is much more concerned with in this film about showing John in the best light. And that doesn't mean she's happy to throw herself under the bus as part of that. But I think she's sort of happy with the idea of having little bits like that in about sort of George Martin saying, oh, she was a bit annoying, that kind of thing. I think she's kind of happy enough with that as collateral damage for the main project, which is, because, you know, as I say, maybe, you know, you could make a case that this documentary is kind of the thing that kicks off the sort of John Lennon legacy project that we know now. And as I say, is maybe the sort of first product release as part of it, which Yoko Ono, I don't mean to say she's approached this in any sort of mercenary way, but she, it's very profitable, right?
Yeah. You know?
So it kind of makes sense for her to just focus on showing John in the best light, even if that means that she doesn't always come off all that
brilliantly. Yeah, that's fair, yeah. But, and also, you know, going back to your first point about this, that I do think this film does a better job than most at addressing the persecution that the pair of them felt when they started in a relationship together. The public persecution. I mean, we obviously covered the US versus John Lennon in a previous episode, in a previous series, which is all about the political persecution of John Lennon and seeing him as a threat to the American government institution at the time. There's a little bit of overlap between that film and this, but actually this goes much deeper into the Ballad of John and Yoko type persecution that they felt just for being in a relationship together that isn't really explored in another film that we've seen to date. And I think having George Martin mention that, even if that's coming from a trusted source, does still add to that same narrative that it did feel like John and Yoko against the rest of the world.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's the footage of when they're coming out of the courthouse after their drugs bust trial, and they're kind of surrounded in the street waiting for their car to turn up, and a girl, you hear her very clearly say, "John, she's horrible. Cynthia's better than her," or something like that. I think that's it.
Yes.
Which is just a horrible thing to say to a person, you know, whether they're famous or not, you know. And also the way that the cartoonist Al Capp treats her in particular when they're having the argument at the bed-in.
That's awful, isn't it?
It's terrible. The way he talks to her, he kind of, well, it talks to John about her as though she's not there.
Yeah.
And while he doesn't say anything overtly racist, I don't think there are certainly racial undertones to the way he's expressing the argument, kind of suggesting that she is in some way shrill, or that she's sort of misunderstanding everything that's being said, or that she is talking too much, that kind of thing. Yeah. It's sort of these sort of tend to be,
barely says anything. Well, which is hilarious.
Well, that's the thing as well. And these tend to be, he's sort of indulging in the kind of tropes that tend to be employed to ridicule Southeast Asian people in general, you know, that kind of seems to be what he's doing, you know. One of those things where if you were to accuse him of being racist there, it would be quite hard to write down on a piece of paper the racist things he says.
Yeah.
But it's just
But everyone's kind of...
it's just, it's there.
"I'm delighted to have met you, Madam New. You are our answer to Madam New.
Great media, Barabbas.
But I'm sure the other three guys, the other three fellas, are Englishmen."
"What does that mean?"
"Think about it. Get out.
I'll try and work it out now, Derek."
"Oh, no, really? Come on."
"But I'm not having these people in shop."
Leave it, though. We asked him here. We asked him his right."
"Forgive me."
"For Derek, it's not me to forgive you. It's for your psychiatrist."
"Christ, you know it ain't easy. You know how hard it can be. The way things are going, they're going to crucify Cap."
My favourite thing that he argues at that point, and it's a horrible moment, really compelling to watch, because it's a bit of a juicy moment, right? As in terms of like gossip and like sensationalist moment in sort of a celebrity event. This actual like thrashing out of a proper argument face to face. A time where you kind of feel like if John wasn't right now trying to promote the idea of peace, he'd probably deck him.
right.
You know, you can sense John getting angry, and deservedly so. I think one of my favourite arguments, though, is when John talks about his songs being for everyone. Yeah. And Al Cap says, "Well, you don't write for me. You don't get to write for me."
Yeah.
And it's like, what a ridiculous argument to make. So what songs are written for you? Which songs did you give your explicit permission to that you feel connected to? You know, well, it's just a sort of hilarious thing to push back on.
Yeah, it's that argument in the film is given, it seems to be shown pretty much in full. Maybe it has been edited a bit, but certainly a lot of time is devoted to it. It's there, I guess, to show the kind of opprobrium and ridicule that they were subjected to in a very, very specific kind of face-to-face way. That argument really seems to prefigure the sort of arguments that really characterize social media discourse these days, in which it's probably unfair to characterize this entirely as a right-wing versus left-wing thing, because it isn't quite that. But in the kind of arguments I'm talking about, someone will either pretend to have misunderstood the other's argument in order to weaken it. They will talk over them a lot and also be very sarcastic and uninterested in listening to the other person's responses because they've made up their mind already. There isn't any point in having the argument. The argument itself is theatre. That's the only reason it's there, you know. So when Al Capp has a joke he wants to make, basically, about, oh, you described yourself as shy, and he's got the front cover of Two Virgins, and he says, is this what shy people do?
Yeah.
And then John and Yoko, I think, start trying to explain quite reasonably that, yes, it's quite possible for shy people to be publicly naked.
Yeah.
Because obviously what he's doing is just taking a very literal reading of the word. And also, like, where does he think this gets him? Like,
yeah.
If they say, okay, fair enough, we're not that shy.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, great, well, you've won. Brilliant. Yeah, yeah. You know, it's a very frustrating encounter to watch. John is obviously furious about it.
Mm.
And Derek Taylor at the end, because I forget what Cap says, but it's something like when he's kind of stood up and he's about to leave, and he says something particularly horrible to Yoko.
I can't believe it is either. But that's when Derek Taylor steps in and he's like, "That is enough." Like he tries to get him to leave.
It just says, "Get out."
Yeah, but John is like, "No." Like we invited him here.
He's right. You know. Yeah, I just think it's a really interesting encounter because you also get in this John and Yoko's argument with the journalist Gloria Emerson. So she came to Apple in 1969, and she had an interview with the pair of them, because basically the point she's making is that you're making yourself look ridiculous by all the bed-in stuff and being in a bag and sending acorns to world leaders and all the rest of it. And she does much more effectively prick John's slight pomposity about the whole thing.
Yeah,
it's actually not even a slight pomposity about it. He was quite pompous at this time. You know, because when he says, well, you know, if it saves lives, and she says, oh, my dear boy, you don't think you've saved a single life. You know, you're living in a dream world, I think she says, you know.
If I'm going to get on the front page, I might as well get on the front page with the word peace.
But you've made yourself ridiculous.
To some people, I don't care.
If it saves lives. You don't think you... Oh, my dear boy, you're living in a nether.
Well, you talk to...
You don't think you've saved a single life. What do you know about a protest movement anyway?
I know a lot about it.
It's a lot more than sending your chauffeur in your car back to Buckingham Palace.
You're just a snob about it. The only way
you're
to make...
You're a fake. Can't you give up something else if it means nothing?
It was no sacrifice to get rid of the MBE because it was an embarrassment.
Then what kind of a protest did you make? I don't know much about an advertising campaign
for peace. Can you understand that?
No, I can't.
A very big advertising campaign for peace.
And self-aggrandizing. Well, you think are you advertising John Lennon or peace?
Do you want nice middle-class gestures for peace and intellectual manifestos written by a lot of half-witted intellectuals? And nobody reads them. That's the trouble with the peace movement.
It is probably fair to say that the promotion that John and Yoko gave to the peace movement, it probably did save the odd life here and there, right? Gloria Emerson actually later said that she felt like the Beatles could have stopped the war in Vietnam by sort of going there and performing to the troops, right? I'm not sure how much I buy that. But it does show that she did believe in the power. She isn't just some sort of establishment figure who's saying, why are you being so ridiculous? You know, she did believe in the power of popular culture and pop music to have an influence on things like Vietnam. By the way, I mean, she's a very, very respected author. She'd lived in Vietnam before. She's a very respected author. She was a war correspondent as well. She went to Saigon in 1970. You know? I mean, she kind of wins that argument, if you like, you know, if there is to be a winner and a loser to these things, especially because John does kind of resort to just kind of like shouting over her, really.
Yeah, he loses his rag quite quickly in that scene. And that is one of those instances where in his promotion of peace, he makes the case in a very unpeaceful way.
You know? Yes. Yeah.
He's at risk of undermining his own argument in that moment in particular. He finds that very frustrating.
I think maybe it's interesting just to see how these are the sort of early days of celebrity activism, right? Mm. Celebrity activism is not unusual these days. Lots and lots of celebrities attach themselves to causes of one kind or another. Perhaps not that many are devoting the sort of time and the column inches to it that John and Yoko are. You know, so their whole thing was, we're going to get on the front pages of the paper anyway, whatever we do, so we might as well do it with the word peace.
Yeah.
Just as an advert. And so, I mean, one point that he does make to Gloria Emerson, which is a very good one, is that one of the problems with the peace movement is that so much of it is led by academics who write sort of long, worthy treatises that no one ever reads. And that's, they're very true. It's as true as activism now as it was then,
mm-hmm.
is that engaging in these things in a meaningful way, it takes time and it takes effort. You know, it's like, you know, I'm as guilty as anyone of just sort of not getting involved in worthy causes as much as I should do, because I haven't sitting down and learning all the stuff I would need to learn to fully understand them.
Yeah,
takes time, and you know, I don't necessarily have the time. You know,
too busy doing this.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, this is too valuable a gift to the world. You know?
I mean, if it saves lives.
Oh, my dear boy. I think, you know, he's sort of making the point quite rightly that this is, celebrities have a valuable role to play in this whole thing, because they can package up a message in quite a neat way, and it doesn't have to be the whole message. You know, mm-hmm. when we talked about the US versus John Lennon, we spoke about John's skill as a sort of sloganeer, you know. And that was the sort of great thing they did, just being able to distill a message. And you could argue that sometimes it would oversimplify that message, but in communicating a message, they were very, very skillful.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
One of the things that's always quite fun throughout this film, I think, because it covers John's early career as well as his later career, is how we see different fans react to him and his work at different points of his life. So quite early on, we have, you know, obviously Beatlemania era, and I think there's footage in this film that was also used in another film that we watched recently, I forget which one, where a young female fan is talking about how long she's waited to catch a glimpse of them, and is very upset that...
Yeah, Complete Beatles, I think that was.
Yeah, I think it was, as well. And that's followed almost immediately by a young man around the same time, very upset. He makes the point that he owns every Beatles record.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. Which is great. It's like he says, I got every Beatles record at home and I didn't even get to see them. Like that would be a prerequisite for an invite.
Yeah, you know, right. I've collected these tokens.
Like, yeah, exactly, yes. Where is my personal audience with the Beatles? But then you also then have later on John walking through Central Park, and you have that fan... he says, like, oh, man, I love you. I can't believe I'm meeting you right now. And immediately says, when are the Beatles getting back together?
Yeah.
And he says, I love your albums. I love your blue album. Which is like, how perfect for John to hear. Oh, brilliant. You love my blue album.
Great. Cheers. The one I had absolutely nothing to do with putting exactly. together. He's quite gracious with that fan. I mean, he's being filmed. But I think in general in New York... So in New York, he would get a bit of that, but he could generally just kind of walk through the park without being mobbed all the time.
Yeah, I think that point was made in another documentary we saw, but it always surprises me that he would just walk through the park.
Yeah.
And could. It seems unlikely now in this day and age, but obviously, you know, it's at a point in his career where he felt a little bit less likely to be completely mobbed.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but it's still surprising to think that he would do that.
Well, I suppose the era of him being a huge, huge celebrity is, well, no, he's still a hugely well-known guy, but I think maybe, I forget whether he attributes it to this, I'm sure I've seen it attributed to the idea that New Yorkers are kind of slightly more aloof, or were at the time.
Yeah.
And unless, you know, if they were bowled over by celebrity, didn't always want to show it, so like, or, you know, he would be kind of left alone, you know. But he does say to that, you know, the guy says, when are the Beatles getting back together? And he says, tomorrow, man. You know,
yeah.
Which is a nice, fun answer.
Yeah.
Because it's short, so he can move on, but not dismissive.
Yes,
and it's,
yeah, I know,
and it's
yeah,
fun.
Yeah, you could just be like, "Shut up!"
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And then obviously, there's a really famous clip which we haven't spoken about before, with the fan turning up at his door, who seems to believe that many of his songs are written about him.
Yeah.
In particular, I feel like that scene gets resurfaced quite a lot.
Yeah,
I see that clip quite a lot, but it's really interesting. And my favourite bit of it, obviously, is when the fan is telling John that he feels like John is speaking personally to him through his lyrics, like when he sings in the song, "Boy, you're going to carry that weight."
Yeah.
And John's very like, "That was Paul."
Don't confuse the songs with your own life. I mean, they might have relevance to your own life, you know, but a lot of things do. So we met, you know, I'm just a guy, man, who writes songs.
Yeah, I figured that if we met, I'd know just by reading them.
But know what?
It all fits.
Anything fits, you know, if you're tripping off on some trip, anything fits, you know.
Like when you said, "Boy, you're going to carry that weight for a long time."
That's Paul saying that.
Yeah. Paul saying
that? Well, that belongs to all of us. He's thinking about all of us.
Remember that one, you can radiate everything you are, you can penetrate anywhere you go?
Yeah. I was just having fun with words. It was literally a nonsense song, you know. I mean, Dylan does that, anybody does it, you know. They just take words and you stick them together and see if they have any meaning. Some of them do, some of them don't.
I do think when he says that, he's quite kind to him in the way he says that. He says it was Paul sung that. But he's singing about all of us, you know, that's for all of us too. I think that scene is really interesting. It's really interesting that it's in there at all. It, like I say, I mean, this film is showing John in the best possible light. And he's really kind and compassionate to the guy now, you know. Would he have invited him in for a cup of tea and toast if there weren't cameras there? I don't know. I get the impression, maybe.
Yeah.
Because you can see...
Because also there isn't actually any need for him to do it with the cameras there. You know, he could be quite as easily very kind and dismissive.
Yeah.
You know, but like you say, I could actually quite believe it would be in his nature to show kindness even more.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, as Yoko says, you know, he felt like, you know, people had taken this from his song, so it was kind of his responsibility, you know. I mean, there is, because there are plenty of, you can go online and see photos that were taken by fans who had just turned up at Beatles' houses in the 60s, but less so at Paul's place in St. John's Wood, but more sort of going out to George's and John's sort of big houses in Surrey, you know, and Friar Park later on, and just kind of like, showed up and knocked on the door and not necessarily been invited in and given tea, but just that they would come out and talk to them and have their picture taken and give them something. Because I just think that celebrity was a very different thing then.
Yeah,
the idea that you had made that much effort, because these would have been fans who had travelled from other countries, as this guy did, who, you know, just all they wanted was an audience for sort of 20 minutes or something, you know.
I think
So this guy's name is Kurt Claudio. So he was sort of referred to as Claudio for years and years. There's a few sort of conspiracy theories going around the internet about him. So what one was on the Dick Cavett show that John and Yoko appeared on, there's a guy in the audience who gets up and asks a question. who was sort of a few people online thought it's the same guy, that he'd popped up here as well. So you can see that clip online. I'll put a link to it in the description. And he, the guy who asked the question does look a little bit like him, but it's not the same person. Also the Dick Cavett show was about 3 months after this encounter at Tittenhurst. So they'd, if it was him, I presume they would have recognized him, like, oh, hi, you're the guy who's in our gun.
Yeah.
But it, so this is in May 1971. And so this guy, Kurt Claudio, he's 22 years old at this point. He was for a long time thought to have been a Vietnam vet. I think Yoko Ono describes him in the later documentary I mentioned, Above Us Only Sky, which includes a longer version of this scene and some more talking head discussion of it. And he's referred to as a Vietnam vet in that. He wasn't one, apparently. That was a misunderstanding, apparently. What he was, surprise, surprise, very heavy LSD user.
Right.
He had become obsessed with the Beatles and kind of thought they were calling to him to come and join them in the UK. So at this point, when he turns up, he's been sending John and Yoko letters, telegrams, and audio tapes saying that he's coming to meet them. So this is
right.
This is not a casual encounter.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Because they know. I think John even replied to his telegram once. He sent him a telegram saying he was going to turn up on this date, and John sent him one back saying, I won't be there, I'm going to Venus or something like that. So John knows who this guy is.
He's
kind of semi-expecting him. So like I say, this guy has been preparing for this. And of course, there's another context in which this is quite chilling, right? Because, you know, he apparently, like, after this encounter, when he got home and he was talking to his friends and family, he felt quite let down by his encounter with John. He felt like he hadn't lived up to the person he thought he was. And this is so similar to how Mark Chapman felt about John.
Sure, yeah.
This is the obsessive nature of the way that he, you know, he said, oh, I'm going to go, you know, I'm going to travel from another country to come and see him. And then I'm just going to go to his house and hang around and see what happens. You know, the guy, like, he looks very lost. And, you know, there's something in the fact as well that he's also, like, really handsome.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and because there were also people online who were suggesting that he was a stooge or an actor because he's got kind of real Hollywood good looks.
But he's got really, like, piercing blue eyes.
Right, exactly. And, you know, and there's something in that that not that kind of makes it more chilling, but just kind of makes the whole experience a bit more intense. And then, you know, you kind of think, I don't think he meant John any harm. But then this, you know, this is exactly the kind of thinking about celebrities, and it's exactly the kind of thinking about people, you know, that led, you know, the guy who went and broke into George Harrison's house, which is called Michael Abrams. It's obsession. It's listening to the records and imagining that you are being spoken to directly, that it's a parasocial relationship, you know. It's sort of imagining that you have a one-on-one relationship with this person because you've consumed their art in some way, and not being able to just sit with that and let that be its own thing. You have to go to the person because you think they want to, they're communicating to you and they want to see you, you know. So I think John deals with it really well, but I always found it quite hard to watch. I think I can remember the first time I saw this film. I would have been kind of too young to know the time. I was aware that John Lennon was dead and had been murdered, but I was kind of too young to know the timeline of this.
Sure.
I think I probably would have watched this film and thought, oh, is this Mark Chapman?
Like, I see.
Not like he's going to get shot on screen, but like, it, you know, because, you know, it would have seemed like, too coincidental that this thing happened twice. Because the echoes are, sometimes I found it like quite hard to watch, you know.
I've seen it a few times. There are moments, I think, throughout John's life that seem to foreshadow his death, aren't there? You know, there's the interview that he gave, I think it was the Rolling Stone interview, where he talks about he's a bit scared to be in America because people running around with guns and stuff.
Yeah.
And in fact, in this film, I found it quite interesting that there's that clip of him and Yoko reading like fan letters.
Yeah.
And he reads one that where a fan has written into him to say that a psychic has let them know that John is going to be assassinated. And so this fan is writing to John to warn him of that.
because
he was told by the ghost of Brian Epstein. But yeah, I mean, that's quite an interesting thing to have included in the film as well, because it almost feels like it's you're almost making light of the fact that actually this is what happens to John later on.
Yeah.
But talking of which, we should probably also talk about how the film does handle John's death, which in the film, there's a lead up to the exact moment or the circumstances around John's assassination. But it's being told at the same time as the film cuts between slow motion footage of glasses similar to John's flying up in the air and then landing down on the ground, the glass in the glasses smashing. I think there's even blood on the glasses rim.
Yeah.
Feels like the kind of thing that nowadays would be seen to be in poor taste.
Yeah, yes, quite possible. So yeah, these are obviously not the same pair of glasses, but Yoko did keep the glasses that John was wearing when he died, and which were bloodstained. She used them, she took a photo of them, used them as the cover of her album Season of Glass. Mm. So that iconography is, I mean, you know, it's hers, and it's hers to do with as she wants. I don't particularly think it's in poor taste, given that that was her husband. You know, I think she sort of earned that right.
What, you know? The photo, you mean?
The photo and the use of the glasses in the
film.
So I mean, the way that his death is shown in the film, it was interesting actually, because I hadn't seen this in a few years and I couldn't remember. I was thinking as they got closer to it, how did they handle his death? I can't remember. And the answer is that it's with a series of still images of John sort of in a taxi coming back to the Dakota, getting out of the taxi and going into the Dakota building, not from the day he died, but essentially depicting a similar taxi journey that he would have made. And then all the while the ascending orchestra bit from A Day in the Life is playing, and then at the point of the sort of crescendo, you see his glasses kind of fly up in the air in slow motion and then land on the ground and smash. I think in general it's quite a good way to do it.
I appreciate that there's not, you know, normally what would happen in a documentary is it immediately someone would make a pointed comment about John's contribution to society, and it would immediately cut to a news reporter on news station announcing the death of John Lennon, right?
Yeah, that kind of thing.
That feels like the cliched way of doing it.
Yeah, of which there's lots, you know, and there's actually quite a lot of good footage. You know, there's the guy, there's the American football commentator who interrupted the commentary to announce that John Lennon had been shot, you know.
Remaining, John Smith is on the line, and I don't care what's on the line, Howard, you have got to say what we know in the booth.
Yes, we have to say it. Remember, this is just a football game, no matter who wins or loses. An unspeakable tragedy confirmed to us by ABC News in New York City. John Lennon, outside of his apartment building on the west side of New York City, the most famous perhaps of all of the Beatles, shot twice in the back, rushed to Roosevelt Hospital, dead on arrival. Hard to go back to the game after that news flash, which in duty bound we had to take. Frank?
Indeed it is.
I always found that quite affecting, because it showed that, you know, even sort of, you know, 10 years after the guy was really a sort of big shot celebrity, the biggest star in the world, even 10 years after that, in America, he'd been taken in as one of their own to such an extent that there's very few people whose death would be like an American football commentator would stop commentating in order to announce their death.
Yes, yeah, I know what you mean, yeah. The other thing I found interesting leading up to John's death is actually a statement that Yoko makes, where she said that she was feeling like she needed some space from John and suggested that he take Sean away for a little while. And he said no. He refused and said, no, I'm going to stay with you this time, is what Yoko says. Implying, of course, that he was thinking about the circumstances around Lost Weekend.
Right.
But the implication there is, because of the situation with the Lost Weekend, and John, either out of guilt or just stubbornness, reacting to that moment and choosing to do things differently, resulted in him dying. Because if he had done what Yoko had asked him, then he would have been somewhere else and might still have lived on.
Yeah. I suppose, like, the way, as we said, The Lost Weekend is not really discussed for what it really was in the film. However, the way the film does it chronologically is John kind of saying, you know, I was lost. I had nobody to look after me. I mean, you know, you had your girlfriend to look after you, but let's gloss over that, you know. And then, you know, I just, you know, I felt like I just needed to be back with Yoko. And then you go into the scene that comes from the just starting over video of the two of them getting undressed and having sex, weirdly.
Yes.
But that is kind of where you then get to in terms of it, not like and then he died immediately.
No, yeah,
but
sure.
But that's kind of what it's saying is that then he sort of got back home, was with Yoko, and then all this stuff happened.
Yeah.
So I didn't draw the exact same conclusion you did in terms of her associating that with the Lost Weekend. I think it's maybe more just the human tendency in events like this to think, well, if only this conversation we had, you know, so many people you hear was sort of, if I hadn't missed my flight, I would have been on the plane that hit the Twin Towers or something like that.
Yes, yeah, exactly, yeah.
I say so many people, there's very few people for whom that's the case. But you know what I mean? Like things like that, there is always a tendency to say, well, what if this had happened instead? You know, it would all have been very different, you know.
Talking of what ifs, I did wonder, watching this film, whether or not we've got into a habit recently. Me and you have got into a habit recently, but I think sort of general Beatles fandom have got into a habit recently of swinging in the direction of reappraising Paul's contribution to the Beatles.
Yeah.
You know, following a time where John was always seen as the true artist, now we're very much in sort of pro-Paul territory.
Right.
He was the driving force and the creative force behind the Beatles. Watching this film, I was really struck by how much I guess I kind of forgotten or started to take for granted just how good a songwriter and musician John is. And I guess I do wonder if in this reappraisal of Paul's contribution to the group, there's a danger that actually we'll start to undermine John's role in all that as well. Because as this film shows, just watching him record in the studio, like there were generally goosebump moments for me watching him record like the vocals to How, and it just felt like a really magical thing to be able to witness.
Yeah.
Genuinely got a similar feeling from watching some of this footage that I hadn't seen for a long time to when I saw Get Back.
Yeah.
I don't know if you agree, but I just wondered if, you know, we might be in a position where we're starting to sort of upweight Paul's value in the band, but at the expense of John's.
Yeah, maybe a bit. Yeah, I suppose maybe that's sort of where the swingometer has gone a bit, hasn't it? I suppose it's interesting. So one of the things about I was kind of on the lookout a bit in this film for how Paul is treated, and while the old Paul and George argument from the Let It Be sessions is trotted out. And there is a bit of a suggestion about Paul being a bit overbearing, but not a lot. So yeah, this film, it doesn't really push the narrative that John was a genius and Paul was the sideman, which is good, you know. I actually, one of the things that occurred to me actually is that there's a very prominent use of real love in this film, which is the sort of acoustic guitar demo that John had done. It's slightly different to the version we ended up with. It's slightly different to the piano version, the sort of piano demo version that we've heard. Also includes a bit in it that had previously been in the song Isolation from Plastic Ono Band, about I don't expect you to understand, or like similar, like, which he's sort of taken from a song that's already been released and sort of stuck a bit into one he's writing, which kind of suggests to me that he was sort of just sticking it in there as a placeholder before, because I think he did eventually replace it, because it's not in the one that you end up with in the piano versions and on on real love. Anyway, it's a bit of a work in progress, seemingly. It's really lovely, and the vocal is really haunting, I think. The whistling is also quite haunting, you know, in a nice way, you know. One of the interesting things about the use of real love in the film, especially as it pertains to Paul, is that it occurred to me that, so it's in 1994, after Paul had inducted John into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame posthumously, that Yoko gave Paul the cassettes with Free as a Bird, Real Love, and Now and Then, and I think Grow Old With Me as well, and said, you know, maybe you can do something with these, you know, which kind of it kicks off what becomes the sort of new songs for the anthology project. Paul later says in an interview that Real Love is a song that he didn't know, but when it was released, you know, sort of hardcore Lennon fans had sort of heard it because it's been around on bootlegs for ages, you know, and said so they were familiar with it, but we weren't. But Paul, so Paul saw this film. It's on record, you know, because he sort of made a public reaction to it, and you know, and said he enjoyed it, you know. So he definitely saw this film, and therefore had heard Real Love. And it's not like Real Love is kind of tucked away in this. It is sung over the opening credits and also the closing credits. It's almost a centerpiece. Not as much as the song Imagine is, but you know, it's used very prominently. And like I say, it's quite haunting, and I can't imagine that Paul would have heard that song and immediately forgotten it. I mean, maybe 6 years later, you know, he's heard so much other music and stuff, you know, that he's that it's not at the forefront of his mind. But for him not to remember it at all when he's given the cassette and said, oh, maybe you want to do something with it, felt a bit odd to me, you know. So I'm not saying he's lying or he's making it up. I think maybe it's another one of those things that's just like a good part of the Beatle narrative, and it's kind of suited him to kind of say, oh yeah, I had no idea these songs existed. They're such a wonderful treasure trove, that kind of thing. Yeah. You know, John always said of Paul, you know, he's the best PR man in the world, you know, and you know, I think there's a bit of truth to that when it comes to things like this, you know.
I think the song itself was released as part of the soundtrack to this film, as well. So it's in terms of it being available, it was widely available. I think the soundtrack to this film did pretty good. You're right, I think it doesn't serve Paul very well for him to be like, I know this song's already out there, but I just kind of liked it, so I wanted to work on it. You know, it doesn't suit the narrative very well. In his defense, the Beatles version, the one that ended up on Anthology 2, is really good.
Yeah,
particularly for, I think, George's guitar. I really love his guitar solo in that song. So I think he made the right choice.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, in one of the nice things about the anthology version of Real Love is it kind of, there is an implicit truce between Paul and George on the thing, because George is allowed to do his answering guitar lines that he wanted to do in Hey Jude, and they fell out over.
Yeah.
which is nice, you know.
I feel like John would have got a kick out of that.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
So I think that probably covers everything that we have to say about the film Imagine, John Lennon. As always, if you've seen this film, or if you have a particular fond memory of the film or strong connection to the film, we'd love to hear from you. As mentioned before, you can reach us on all the usual social media platforms. We are at Beatles Films Pod. You can also go and check out some of our earlier episodes we've recorded, including some of the films that you've mentioned in this episode. For example, The Complete Beatles, the Beatles documentary from 1982, and the US versus John Lennon, as well as a whole bunch of other episodes focused on films that the Beatles are actually in, including Help and Magical Mystery Tour, Yellow Submarine, and a whole host of others. If you've enjoyed this episode or any of those episodes or any of the episodes that we've released so far, you can leave us a 5-star rating or a review, and that would be much appreciated. Otherwise, we will see you again next week for another episode. And until then, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.